Hi, it's Zoe, and on today's podcast, we have the remarkable Cheryl Moon. She's an extraordinary woman who is one of the pioneering first ladies in IT, and in this interview today, we go through the amazing trajectory of her career, we look at social contribution and social justice, and the interesting cross-section between IT and art, and all of that and what it can do to inspire you. So let's get into it.
Welcome to the Zoe Routh Leadership Podcast, your source of strategies and insights to make you a better leader. Influence, improve, inspire.
Hi, this is Zoe Routh, and I'm here with the extraordinary Cheryl Moon, who is the Chief Inspiration Officer at Spinify, another local local Canberran business, which is set to do extraordinary things. So I'm going to let Cheryl tell her story in just a moment. She's had a huge variety of trajectories in her career through art and IT, and it's just a wild ride. So I'm going to get her to fill in the gaps. And so welcome, Cheryl.
Thanks, Zoe. Hey, my current role is as Chief Evangelist for Spinify.
Oh, Chief Evangelist, sorry.
Which is just a really, really cool title, and I have a really cool job with Spinify. I work very closely with Matt Bullock, who's an inspirational entrepreneur based here in Canberra, developed a company called eWay over 18 years and sold it for many millions of dollars to a Fortune 500 company in 2016. Once he sold that, he then set up Spinify, and having worked for him at eWay, I came across to work with him at Spinify. So that's where I am currently. So he's right. I've had a bit of a potted career. I'm not one of those people who's followed a vertical career. I've moved across as things have interested me, as opportunities have presented themselves. But predominantly I've worked in, I guess, what I would classify as non-traditional areas for women. So lots of IT in my career, having worked for IBM, for Anderson Consulting, which is now Accenture. Then gone on to Manpower and worked in a global job for them, managing 75 countries across the world for the front-end applications.
Just a question about that. Are they still called Manpower?
Yes, they are still called Manpower.
They don't call them People Power?
No.
Okay.
No, and, you know, it's one of those, it's one of those terms, I think, when you understand the history. So the two men who set up Manpower in Milwaukee after the Second World War, there was not enough manpower to do all the jobs that were required post-war. And so the history is very important to Manpower as a company. And once you understand that, it's not quite as gender-biased as we might think.
Okay.
Yeah, so they were a great organisation to work for. Then I took a small diversion and was asked to work for the Australian Information Industry Association. Because of my IT background, I worked specifically with them as the CEO to raise the profile of women in technology. So during my career, whether it's been an official part of my career or, you know, extracurricular, I've certainly worked to advance the role of women in non-traditional careers, particularly in the STEM environment, and then also to help women at specific career points to decide what their career path might look like, and that it's okay to take big, bold steps. Because they often deliver or wildly exceed your expectations about what your career could be.
Yeah, absolutely. So STEM, for those who aren't familiar with that acronym, what does it stand for?
So STEM is science, technology, engineering, and math. And I think it's quite interesting now that in the US there's a movement to turn STEM into STEAM by adding art, because there's a view that, in fact, the creative elements go very nicely with the STEM elements in order to be or in order to be not just creative, but innovative, and to advance economies through innovation. So I'm kind of behind that little push at the moment in the US with friends in the US, and really interested to see where that goes. Having spent a part of my career running art environments and investing in art and brokering in art, so I'm very keen to see the kind of right and left brain balance up to push through innovation, because we definitely need that in our world at the moment.
Mm. So you're obviously a passionate advocate, and we're sitting here in Cheryl's fantastic apartment. It's just got glorious pieces of artwork everywhere. How have you seen, I mean, you've talked about left brain, right brain, complementary thing in IT. How have you seen your passion for art complement your work or support the work that you do in IT?
It's always been a bit of an adjunct to my work in IT, and in some ways it's been the high touch to my high-tech environment, because it's allowed me to interact with people who have a different way of viewing the world, who may not have the same, you know, business acumen that I've certainly developed in my career. So that kind of mutually beneficial relationship to promote their works, to ensure that they get paid for their efforts. You know, I think artists more than any other career or profession suffer from the, well, that's really a nice piece. Why don't you give it to me and, you know, I'll put it up on my wall, or I'll put it in my gallery, or I'll promote it and you'll get lots of exposure. So artists in our environment are highly underrated in terms of the effort and the passion that goes into a single piece of art, regardless of what that is, whether we're talking wearable art or we're talking paintings or we're talking sculpture, ceramics. You know, people don't just knock up stuff.
Mm. That's right. And I had a sense of that. We were recently in New York over the Christmas break. We went to the Museum of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and it was extraordinary. They have an extraordinary collection there, and it gave me a true appreciation for what goes into the creation of a piece of work. Because it's not just the doing, it's the seeing. And I think artists see the world in different ways that allows us to change how we see the world. And you see that with things like the cusp of change of perception with people like Picasso, radically changed how we see the world and interpret the world and create an interpretation of reality. So I think artists are true beacons, seers, I guess. Seers is probably the right word or the terminology I might use for our culture. And they've lost a lot of status and appreciation over the last couple of centuries, really. And I love the fact that art is being incorporated into IT, and I think that's a great sign that technology is coming into its own in terms of being able to spearhead the evolution of culture, because it is, you know, it's got the innovation of robotics and AI, which is at the forefront of the robotic apocalypse, if you read some sayers, or, you know, the revolution of how we work and the end of work. There's some conversations around that. And it's not just in America, it's also in Australia. So I met with the Australian Computer Association here in the ACT, and they're keen to incorporate that as well. So,
oh, that's great news.
Yeah. So they're looking at how they can extend their training and development to incorporate that aspect of creativity and tech.
It's interesting, Zoe, just as you were talking about what's happened over the last couple of centuries, because I can draw some kind of more specific parallels between art and technology. So if we go back, you know, to the Middle Ages and to, you know, people like Michelangelo, then he did his artwork on three separate levels. So the first thing they did with the canvas was to put a dirt layer on. So the dirt layer reacted with the canvas and kind of formed the kind of glue so that it would last forever, which is why paintings from that era do last forever.
Like dirt off the street?
Dirt off the street.
Yeah, right, okay.
And they mixed it with a bonding agent, it might have been a glue, to bond it to the, as an adhesive, to bond it to the canvas. Then came a form layer. So they would form out what the artwork was going to look like. So with their oils or with a diluted oil, they would make the form. So they might draw the church or the Mona Lisa and put it all in perspective. And then the final layer was the colour layer.
Hmm.
So that's when they would finish it off. So if I look at how paintings are formed and how great art even today is formed, it still follows that methodology of layers. And if I look at technology, it's the same. You know, Spinify is a gamification company. So we have games that improve business processes. But you still have to go through a layered approach. You know, it's not that there wasn't a magic thing that suddenly made a game in the Apple App Store. You know, there's a foundation layer. There's the back end. So the back end game mechanics. Then there's the design. And the biggest part of a game is the design. And again, that's where the creativity comes in. So you get an end product in both situations, but there's all those layers underneath that sometimes get forgotten in how we value both technology and art.
Oh, I think that's right. Like, I was hosting Leadership Over Lunch yesterday, which is my monthly network gathering, and one of the major trends I see out there in business is this trend towards desire for friction-free. And if you notice all the little things that irritate you about your day, they're often technology-related. And we've become very impatient with technology, even though it's changed our world in so many ways and made life so much better in so many ways. But even things like, for example, I was trying to pay for my parking using an app yesterday. And I had to log into the app where usually it's just open, and I was like, I can't remember my password. And it's like, do you forget your password? I'm like, I'm not going through that crap. You know, you have to get the email. And then so I gave up and I just used my credit card. And such a tiny little thing. It's a little piece of friction in our lives. And we forget all that amazing design and layering that has gone into producing a free app that allows you to hopefully have a more seamless experience.
Correct.
And so I think you're right. We are dismissive of technology, even if, you know, oh, we have to upgrade our software again on the phone. It seems like every 2 weeks we have to do that, and it's just such an impediment. And yet, we're not appreciative of all the hours of work that went into upgrading and making that. So, I love that parallel. That's really fascinating. It sort of opens our eyes to what we don't appreciate and what is there to value. I'm curious about a couple of things Iwe is a fabulous Canberra entrepreneurial story with Mapalook, who set it up and transformed this payment gateway into an international force, if you like. And you've been part of that journey for a long time. And I think Matt Bullock has a compassionate side, he's obviously a fierce entrepreneur, and he's launching as much energy into Spinify as he did into Iwe, I'm sure. He's a very fierce man. And he's also very committed to philanthropy. So can you tell us a little bit about what happened at Iwe in terms of how he embraces philanthropy and his social contribution there, and also how you see that fitting into business from your point of view?
Of course. So Matt is very focused on philanthropy, and for a long time, before he set up his foundation, which is a recognised charity in Australia, and he's put money into the foundation to do very specific philanthropic things, and I'll talk about those. But before that, Matt was a very strong supporter of OzHarvest, which deals with providing meals to disadvantaged Australians. So he's a very big supporter of that, did the CEO cook-off year after year after year, and made personal donations to the organisation. He's always been a long-term supporter of Ronald McDonald House. And, you know, often philanthropy comes from our personal experiences. So Matt's son had a life-threatening thing happened to him when he was born, and so he was rushed off to Sydney, and Matt and Wendy spent time in Ronald McDonald House in Sydney. So since then, so that would be the last 8 years, they have supported Ronald McDonald House. They have subsidised rooms here in Canberra for Ronald McDonald House, very strong. And that personal commitment to organisations like Ronald McDonald House and to OzHarvest have now transferred across to the foundation. And
what is the foundation called?
It's the Spinify Foundation.
Yep.
And one of the important components of the foundation is that Spinify is a partner of the Pledge 1% philanthropy initiative. And, you know, so many of the great companies in the world, particularly in the tech environment, so organisations like Salesforce and Atlassian, which is another great Australian company, have all taken the Pledge 1%. And what that means is that those are organisations who are prepared to commit either 1% of their revenue or 1% of their profits, so 1% of a financial commitment, 1% of their time. So companies who are Pledge 1% partners provide the opportunity for staff to pledge 1% of their time to charities that they're interested in. So, you know, it's not just from the CEO, but it goes right down through the staff in the organisation. And the third component is providing product, 1% of product, to not-for-profit organisations. So it's a very comprehensive way of giving back to the community.
So 1% sounds like not very much. And so I'm wondering, because it's one and it's a percentage, obviously that translates into a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of product when you have such big companies. What does that typically look like? Have you got like end dollar figures or end time figures for some of those companies?
Look, I don't have them ready to hand, but they'd certainly be on the Pledge 1% website.
Okay.
And there's a whole list of partners on there as well, plus videos of people making the pledge. So Matt made the pledge with Scott Farquhar from Atlassian, so it was really nice, two Australian very successful entrepreneurs. And it's interesting now that Scott Farquhar, for example, has decided to take a year off just to give back to the community.
Wow, what do you mean? So is he volunteering? What's he doing?
He's volunteering. He's looking at more ways that successful organisations and successful individuals can solve the problems of the world. And if you think about entrepreneurship, I mean, it requires really a 24/7 mentality, often for many, many years. So the nice thing is that, you know, he's had the opportunity to do that. And, you know, Matt Bullock has certainly taken some time to think about what the foundation looks like for him as well. And in the last 12 months has provided a lot of support for the Canberra Innovation Network and the Kiln Incubator here in Canberra, both in terms of sponsorship and in personal time to work with budding entrepreneurs and budding startups.
What's it, the Kiln Incubator? Is that how you say it?
Yes.
K-I-L-N?
Yes.
Okay, great. Fantastic. So he's obviously passionate about entrepreneurialism because he's such a successful one. Encouraging other entrepreneurs to go for it is really important. And I think you're right. I think there's a lot of business people out there who feel a sense of commitment to the community and want to contribute to solving the problems.
So the Pledge 1% started off with Atlassian and Salesforce, but encouraging people right from their early start-off days, when pledging 1% of, you know, nothing or $50,000 is tiny. And maintaining that pledge as you grow then takes it from a very small contribution to the community, but still a contribution, to what is, for some of those companies, a very large contribution. Mm. And I think there's, it's a very rewarding to see what you give back grow over time as you are a more and more successful entrepreneur.
Oh, absolutely. I was talking to Todd Wright of Three Sides Marketing as well, and that was his advice to every startup business, is to start from the beginning, to have a sense of social contribution, whether it be time, because often you don't have 2 cents to rub together when you're starting a business, as you said, so 1% of nothing is not much. And it gives you a great sense of fulfillment to do that. And you're right, it is rewarding to be able to see how much more you can contribute as you grow. As your success grows, you can continue to contribute, and that contributes to ongoing success. So a lot of pushback from new business owners would be like, I'm just struggling to make ends meet. How would you come back to them with that? You know, like if they're really struggling to make ends meet and the idea of social contribution seems like another burden. Have you met people like that? And what advice would you have for them?
To be honest, we don't meet many, because I think there's a growing awareness that we all have something to give back to our communities. And that goes for individuals as well as for businesses. And certainly what I see, particularly now amongst young people coming through universities, because we do some work with universities as well, is that they want to be part of solutions, you know, technology solutions in particular, because that's what we work with them on, that make the world a better place. So, you know, if I go back to the start of my career in the 1980s when I joined IBM, I mean, it really was the greed is good era. Mm. So there was very little personal responsibility or personal accountability for making the world a better place. Mm. And I'm pleased to say in the, you know, the last 40 years or 30 years, whatever it is, we've moved on from that, where I think it's very high on our conscious level that we have an obligation to help people who are less fortunate than ourselves, or organisations who are less fortunate than we are, particularly if we've been successful in business.
I think that's, it's obligations, it's almost a calling, a sense of with great success comes great responsibility. So the entrepreneurs I've met who are very generous don't feel it as an obligation necessarily. They feel it as something that they want to do. So they do it through gratitude and compassion. And I love the fact that you've pointed out that the greed is good mentality has shifted a lot. Now, it's still alive and well in some sectors. If we think about some of the global financial crisis and how much that notion of greed is good kind of corrupted people and led to such crazy decisions, you know, and had such massive repercussions. And I think when we have such a big incident like that, the antithesis arises, you know. It's like, greed is good, really? What about compassion? And compassion and contribution can help us become even more prosperous as an entire community. And the more prosperous the community, the more prosperous the businesses. So that's a lovely, lovely observation, a lovely link as well. I'm curious about your job title, so which I got wrong. Apologies for that in your intro. Chief Evangelist. So how, like, was there much thought that came into that? Like, where's that coming from?
So Matt's always liked to work in a titleless environment. I mean, Eway, Spinify, very flat organizations. It's very peer-to-peer relationships. It's more about the team working together to solve problems. And particularly with Spinify, where we had 6 months to go from zero to kind of hero and develop 2 game products, one for the Android and one for the iOS platforms, and all of the back-end game mechanics to a launch date. And that was a hard launch date, so we'd taken a booth at Dreamforce. The initial system was built on Salesforce, so it was a very hard deadline. And that worked really well, because the team just mucked in and did whatever it took. It's a long time, you know, I'd have to go back to the 80s to when I really, really coded. But even I picked up some of the coding and testing, like unit testing, to make sure that we presented professionally, which we did. And when we were going off to Dreamforce, we did make the decision that we needed to have cards, and being a kind of dot-com Silicon Valley style company, we thought about having things which were quirky and that people would notice and people would remember, and then people would come back and talk to us, which is what happened. And so, yeah, no, Matt, who's incredibly creative, said to me, oh, you know, why don't you be the chief evangelist? And I went, yes, I've always wanted to be the person. I mean, I am very passionate about what I do, and particularly about, you know, our products. So I'm like, yeah, that's me. That's what I'll be doing. I'll be just talking about it. I'll be selling it. I'll be spreading my passion to other people about how they can change business processes. And it's interesting because my entire career has been about helping people change their business processes in order to be more successful. So if I go back to my IBM days, I was at, you know, at IBM when people were moving their manual accounting processes, their financial processes, their inventory processes from, you know, ledgers or books to computers. And so that was all about business process re-engineering or business process improvement. And gamification does exactly the same thing, because it gamifies the activities that people do to make them more engaged. So you've got a more engaged workforce, you've got people who are happier work because they're playing games and having fun, and you've got better business results. So it's perfect for me to talk about, because that's really what my career's been all about.
And a lot of fun in there too, for sure.
Oh yeah, definitely fun. Yep.
So you've got clients now who've adopted the Spinify technology and mm-hmm. app are implementing it. So what kind of projects or roles do they incorporate the Spinify app into, and what kind of results are you seeing?
So initially when Matt thought about the product, he thought about it for sales teams, because, you know, there's been incentive competitions for salespeople since the 1800s and since drapers gave their salespeople an incentive to sell out of stock or ends of roles. So the incentive competition, the spiff, goes back for a long, long time.
Is that what a spiff is, an incentive competition?
Yes, it's a specific performance incentive fund, because that was the money that was put aside. So specific performance is what it was all about. So you have to do this specific activity in order to get the money.
Okay.
So we thought about salespeople, but then, you know, I've managed service teams and I've managed back office people. So they also have activities. They have very specific activities. So then by the time we got to Dreamforce, we recognized that the product had a wider application than just salespeople. That said, so some of the applications have now, so we do have people using it with their sales teams. We have people using it with their admin teams. We have two organizations, and I've just today been talking to a third organization who are using it to drive training and learning in their organizations. So people have to do specific courses, you know, usually in large corporations, yeah, in order to progress in their career or to do their professional development. They need to do a series of courses. So most companies leave that to be an opt-in, because that's it should be something that people want to do. But now they're looking at how they incentivize that process by running a game, because everyone's used to a game and they get points and they get badges and they get levels. And that's working very well to drive learning outcomes. So, you know, we never thought about driving that specific activity, but the guys who are using it are just raving about it.
It harks back to the Boy Scouts and brownies. My niece, who's 7, is in the brownies, and she's obsessed with getting badges.
Yeah.
And I think that's the whole principle of gamification. It gives you something tangible to strive for. That gives you a sense of satisfaction once you get it. I'm curious about the sales piece, though, because I think one of the things that we recognize, and I'm sure you guys have addressed that, is that, and I think you talked about this a little bit, when you incentivize results instead of the actual activity that needs to generate the results. So what have you seen as what happens in the behavior if you just incentivize results versus the process of sales?
So I think most people know that if you do more activities, so if I'm a salesperson, if I make more calls, if I send more quotes, if I have more meetings, then I will drive the sales because you have a big funnel that you kind of narrow down as you go over time. So one of the things we talk about is changing activity-based behaviors. So not ABC, but ABB. Because that's what gamification and Spinify does. It helps organizations effortlessly change activity-based behaviors because the games run on the activities. So as you said, you know, it's I see my progress in the game, in the, whatever the landscape is, and we've got a number of different landscapes or different worlds that people play in. I see my progress by completing an activity. So, you know, if the metric is 50 calls, then, you know, I progress so many steps for every call I make. The other important thing is that games give you immediate performance feedback. Immediately. I'm not waiting for a manager to tell me whether I'm doing the right or the wrong thing. I can see, because I can see my colleagues, I can see if I'm doing the same level of activities that they're doing. I can see if I'm falling behind, if I need to do more.
Oh, it's public, is it? It's not just a private thing. There's like a dashboard where we can see everybody else.
Yes, okay. And in the game, I can see everybody. So the game world, it's like a multiplayer online game. So I can see all of my colleagues in the game. I can see who's, you know, fast approaching the rocket. I can see people who are kind of falling behind. I can see everyone, and I can always see where I am because I have a slightly different halo than my colleagues. So I can always pinpoint, okay, that's me. Who's in front of me? Yeah. What are they doing? How many activities are they doing? Because that's what I need to do. And as you said, it's the self-motivation. So we're all looking for frictionless, as you referred to, and this is a way to help managers manage people in a frictionless way because they'll manage themselves with that motivation of, whoa, I'm clearly not doing as many activities as my friends. So a little bit of that peer pressure, that healthy competitive qualities that we all have.
Yeah, I think that's the important caveat, right? Because it could turn evil potentially, but that takes a lot of management as well to make sure that it does maintain healthy and it doesn't get corrupted. My friend Stacey Barr, who is a performance measurement specialist, is often very cautious about designing measures that are going to make sure that promote good behavior as opposed to ones that drive, illegal or unethical behavior just to get the results.
Oh, so, correct. Yeah. Absolutely. And one of the things that a number of our customers are using, because, you know, Matt's obviously managed teams, I've managed teams, what normally happens in a competition is that there's a good player. So if we're talking about making phone calls, there will be people in your sales team who always make the most calls. So what we've talked to customers about doing and what they are doing is matching their games to the competency level of people. So you would put your high performers in a different game with a different metric and a different reward to your core performers and to your lowest performers, because I think you referred to it earlier, Zoe, about the good feelings. So to motivate people to want to do more, they have to have the winning feeling. Yeah. And if it's just one big contest and the top person always wins, then nobody else gets to experience that.
Oh, it's just like a handicaps system, if you like.
Yeah. Although, you know, when I'm competing, if I'm one of the core performers, then I'm competing against people. It's a level playing field.
Yeah, got it.
Yep. And what it does, of course, is give those people the winning feeling, so they want to do more, and over time, you're lifting your very poor performers up to the core performers up to top performers. And if you think about a small lift in each of those individuals will deliver a very big lift in revenue, in deals, in cases closed, if you're talking about service teams, to the organization. So, you know, it's just a beautiful flow.
Yeah, that's great. How much fun are you having over there at Spinify? You guys, how big is your team now?
So we've got 12 people here in Canberra, and then we've got people in the US and in Canada, and then we've got a couple of really, really expert technical people, one in Poland and one in Croatia.
Wow.
And then we use about, at the peak of our development, probably about 120 freelance people. So we're very good at going out and finding the right person for the job. And you don't need the right person necessarily for the entire time. So for voiceovers, for example, or for some of our designs, or how should we set up our standard Dreamforce, we found people, freelancers, who would give us all that information, a very discreet project, and you know that was the end of the relationship. So we've got core employees, and then we've got a bunch of associates that we call on.
Fantastic. So we talked a little bit about Matt Bullock's passions when it comes to philanthropy. What are the causes that matter to you?
I think they're pretty broad. I'll give you an example. I've always contributed to things like Movember or cancer. Cancer affects all of us. So, giving to those causes, donating time, marriage equality, even going back when it was about gay pride. So volunteering time to serve on stalls or on fronting up to a couple of the rallies and giving out papers and talking to people and taking some of the negative feedback. So when we're in Santa Fe is in New Mexico, and we had a house there for a long time as tourists. We used to go backwards and forwards, and then we bought a business there. And New Mexico has the lowest level of education in the US out of the 50 states. Mm-hmm. It has one of the lowest levels of living conditions. One of the Christmases we were there, 25 people froze to death.
Oh my goodness.
Homeless people. Wow. So that should never happen.
That's amazing.
Anywhere. And so, we became quite passionate about not just being philanthropic, but working in community organizations and in political organizations in order to change the way social equality and social justice was delivered. And I've certainly done that here in Australia as well. It is about change. I'm a huge advocate that you change things from the inside. It's harder to change them from the outside. Mm-hmm. So getting involved in not-for-profit boards, in not-for-profit organisations, volunteering time, there's huge opportunities for people to give back if they don't have money, to find a small amount of time to give back to community organisations in their community.
So, with the marriage equality piece, is that because on principle you believe in that, or do you have a personal story in relation to that you wanted to support people, or is that just one of the things you felt was an important value for you?
So, if I go back to when I was growing up, even from the from the time I was kind of 11 or 12, my sister and I would run stalls in our front yard to raise money for. There was a home for Down syndrome children.
Yeah.
And so we would raise money for them. And as we kind of went through our teenage years at school, we'd run stalls, we'd, door knock to raise money for people who were less advantaged, more disadvantaged than we were. So, and that's kind of carried through most of our life. When I joined IBM, I really was one of the first women involved in IT in Australia, in computers in Australia. And so I had a very strong sense of equality and social justice, as a feminist does, for all people.
Yeah.
And so it's bigger than just gender bias. And then you see
you know, women were disadvantaged and certainly faced a lot of discrimination in the workplace. And then that translated into other groups within our society, of which people who have a different sexual persuasion than I do were clearly disadvantaged. And I had a lot of friends in the 80s who didn't make it through AIDS, for example. So, you know, there's no reason why all of us shouldn't live equally in love.
Thank you. That was that's powerful. It's it doesn't surprise me that as a child you were door knocking and raising funds. You know, you're a very compassionate, determined person with a big heart, and that's sort of shown up through your work. And I feel very privileged to have heard your story and today, and I'm really excited to share that with our listeners in terms of inspiring other people to be fierce and compassionate at the same time. Mm. So thank you so much for coming on the show, Cheryl.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Zoe. And, you know, it's really been lovely to have known you for a couple of years now and to be involved in the sort of things that you're doing to change our society as well.
That's right. And you can come along and meet Cheryl. She's going to be a table host at the Edge of Leadership on Conference in March, where you get to spend some time with her. So thanks again.